meant to be governed by human beings.
That's a Strauss philosophy of Plato, Protagoras, Session 14, May 12, 1965.
The Roman coat holder has a proper function. The Roman coat holder has a proper function.
It seems to me that all the difficulties of this dialogue are concentrated in the last section which we are discussing now. I will say to you the difficulties in the form of questions. Perhaps we can solve them. I'm by no means certain that I can. Now, there are three things. The emphasis on courage or manliness. This is the theme. Is courage identical with manliness? Is wisdom identical with courage or not? Why that emphasis on manliness? Second, Socrates tries to prove the identity of manliness and wisdom on the basis of the premise that the good is identical with the pleasant. Why is that? And third, this premise is not accepted by Protagoras, nor is it accepted by the many. And yet Socrates establishes this in a dialogue within the dialogue between Socrates and the many. Why does he bring in the many? These are the three glaring questions, and we can only hope that we get an answer to them. But I don't promise it. Now, I will only give a brief repetition, slightly enlarging what I said last time. Now, courage is the only virtue, according to Protagoras, which is surely not wisdom or knowledge. And that means the only virtue which Protagoras or anybody else cannot teach, because you can only teach knowledge. At the same time, it is the only virtue ascribed by Socrates to Hippocrates. Now, if Protagoras teaches something different from what every Athenian teaches, the political art which he teaches cannot be what he calls political virtue, i.e. justice, piety, and moderation, to the exclusion of wisdom and courage. The political art requires, in a broader sense, in the sense in which he means it originally and not after having been warned by Socrates and therefore made these fishy statements. Political art, in which Hippocrates is interested, requires on the part of the pupil who wishes to go into politics a particular drive or energy, as we would say today, which only few men possess. And that is loosely meant by courage. This, his whole notion of the political art, which Protagoras did not develop owing to Socrates' warning, don't forget that you are in Athens, stands and falls by the fact that wisdom differs from courage. If, however, wisdom and courage were identical, it would follow either that Hippocrates, being courageous, is already wise and therefore doesn't need Protagoras, or else that Hippias is not courageous and the kind of drive which he possesses is not courage. And hence he would not have any special natural fitness for becoming the pupil of Protagoras, but only his wealth, which is of course an important conservation for Protagoras. Now Socrates has tried to prove that courage is and wisdom are the same, and he has clearly failed, although not for the reason given by Protagoras. Furthermore, in stating his view of courage, Protagoras in fact brings courage very close to wisdom. I do not know whether this has to come quite clear last time in 351b beginning. Then he says, courage comes from nature and good breeding of the soul. And if you turn to the first statement of Protagoras' subject in 349b 6 to 8, you will find many men most unjust and impious and licentious and unteachable and yet outstandingly courageous. In other words, courage contains nothing of an intellectual element, and here at least good feeling of the soul that could remind us of the intellect. Now, why the whole dialogue turns around Hippocrates? We must never forget that the only one of the few glimmers of light we have in our misery. Hippocrates is, however, not the only motif of this dialogue. Equally important and not unconnected with the Hippocrates motif is Protagoras' peculiarity, what distinguishes him from all other men, and that is his candor. Of course, very important for young Hippocrates, because he will know exactly where he stands if that claim of Protagoras is justified. Now, the question of candor is not explicitly discussed, but only implicitly. And it comes to the fore in the Simonides section, where we have seen a confrontation of the two ancestries, Socrates and Protagoras, and both were not characterized by candor, whereas Protagoras is the candid man. Now, Socrates takes the side of the concealers, the laconizers, or the makers of long speeches, like Simonides. Now, but what? There are two kinds of concealment, one stemming from justice and one stemming from fear. Simonides, highly praised by Socrates, practiced the latter, which means Simonides was wise but not courageous. So the whole issue of concealment implies the question of the relation of wisdom and courage. Protagoras says there is no need for concealment, i.e., there is a harmony between wisdom and the city, and therefore no need for courage of the wise man. The question of courage doesn't arise. But if there should be a disharmony between wisdom and the city, the wise man must be either stand up or be courageous, or adjust himself, or be cowardly. The question of courage necessarily arises for the men who believe in concealment. I mentioned in this connection a point which I didn't bring out on the earlier occasion, the proper occasion. Now, if there is a harmony between philosophy or wisdom and the city, i.e. the two good things, then pre-political life is the bad thing. Or to use a simple term, civilization is simply good. There's no problem of civilization. But if there is a disharmony between wisdom and the city, there is a problem of civilization. Pre-political life is not the bad thing. There are vices of civilization which are as bad as the defects of pre-philosophic life. Now Protagoras, who says there is no need for concealment, that there is a harmony between the philosophy and the city, also says there is no problem of civilization. Pre-political life is absolutely terrible, and compared with it, everything now is just wonderful. You remember that statement in 327d. The Platonic view is stated, one can say, in the law 678a. Civilization is the simultaneous development of virtues and vices. In passing, I remark that there is a certain similarity between Protagoras and the modern Enlightenment, as represented by Hobbes especially, on the one hand, and Socrates and Rousseau's critique of the Enlightenment on the other. This, I believe, is generally known, although probably not universally known, but we must not forget that there are also very important differences. In other words, there is, well, if we make it, but there is also there is a proportion, there is no identity. But there is something which the Protagoras and Socrates share by the mere fact that they are not monarchs, and which Hobbes and Rousseau share by the mere fact that they are monarchs. This latter question is somewhat more subtle and more difficult to answer, but of course that's not a reason for disregarding. Now I think we should now continue where we left off. That was in 351b. So the situation is this. Socrates has tried to prove without success that wisdom is identical with courage. He says, now he seems, he turns now apparently to an entirely different subject. Will you read this, Mr. Ryan?
I said, you would admit, Protagoras, that some men live well and others ill? He assented. And do you think that a man lives well who lives in pain and grief? He does not. But if he lives pleasant.
No, there's all this indirect speech. He denied it. He denied it. Yes? Go ahead.
But if he lives pleasantly to the end of his life, will he not in that
case? Now, literally, if he will end his life pleasantly. If living pleasantly, he would end his life.
Yes. He would end his life. Will he not, in that case, have lived well? He assented.
No, now he says...
He will.
To me, yeah, I agree. You see, because Socrates forces him now to answer in his own name, and not merely to say what the others say. Yeah. Yes?
Then, to live pleasantly is good, and to live unpleasantly, safe. Yes, he said.
Now let us stop here for 1 minute. Socrates proposes that the good is identical with the pleasant. This is very strange, because in the sister dialogue with the Gorgias, Socrates asserts exactly the opposite, that the good is radically different from the present. This they do especially in the Kaligrad section, where this is the theme. Now, why does he here proceed in the opposite manner? Well, it's not clear. We must wait and see. Or do you have an answer, Mr. Ryan?
Well, with your last discussion, the Maimonides section drew out a distinction from that section on the basis of some virtues being both good and pleasant, and others being simply good, some being self-compulsion, others just compulsion, suggesting that if this distinction breaks down, then the Maimonides section provides the link to the unity of the virtues. Socrates is not going to break down the distinction by persuading the good.
Yeah, whether that is sufficient, I doubt very much. We get an inkling already here. To live well means to live pleasantly. And now in the passage which we insist on the little translation, if living pleasantly, he would end his life. In other words, that is, ending the life is popularly called dying. What about dying pleasantly? Furthermore, death casts its shadow on our whole life. Can one live pleasantly if one fears death? And can one help fearing death unless one knows that death is not an evil, or at least not the greatest? But this knowledge is a core of genuine courage. This shows also why the wise men, that is, the men who are best at living well or pleasantly, must be courageous, because otherwise the greatest pain, the greatest fear, will spoil all pleasure. But if the wise are courageous, why do they give in to tyrants, as Simonides did, and thus show lack of courage? Now, surely the case of Socrates is not identical to that of Simonides, but Socrates answers the question, the apology of Socrates 31b, why did you not go into politics? The fictitious question addressed to him by the audience. Well, I would have been killed. Now, of course, but does it mean that Socrates was afraid of death, or did he think he was still useful? While he felt he was no longer useful when he was dead. That is the question which we must not hear. Now, so let us go on here. Now Protagoras is already speaking for himself, and Socrates has said, to live pleasantly is good, and to live unpleasantly is bad. What does Protagoras say?
Yes, he said, if he lives so as to find pleasure in what is good and noble.
No, it's a noble thing. If he lives deriving pleasure from the noble thing only. So, in other words, Protagoras opposes the simple equation of the good with the pleasure, only certain kinds. Only the noble pleasant things are good. Yes. So that is important. Protagoras does not accept the premise of the whole argument that the good is unqualifiedly identical with the pleasant. Yes?
And do you, Protagoras, like the rest of the world,
like the many,
call some pleasant things evil and some painful things good? For I say that things are good insofar as they are pleasant, if they have no consequences of another sort, and insofar as they are painful, they are bad. I do not know, Socrates, he said. whether I can venture to assert.
Well, now, let us first see what it is. Now, this was Socrates. I'm sorry. Now, Socrates. I'm sorry. Read this on.
I do not know, Socrates, he said, whether I can venture to assert in that unqualified manner in which you ask that all pleasant things are good and the painful evil, having regard not only to my present answer, but also to the whole of my life. I shall be safe, if I am not mistaken, in saying that there are some pleasant things which are not good, and that there are some painful things which are not evil, and some which are, and that there are some which are neither good nor evil.
Yes. Now, you see, Socrates first appealed, as it were, to the snobism of Protagoras. You don't agree with the view of the many, do you? But this doesn't make any impression on Protagoras. Protagoras has been chastened, as you see. He has learned to be well advised and not only think of the present situation, what might get him out of a fix, because it might bring him into a fix another case. But he has learned this in his old age. His answer must be good not only for the moment, but in harmony with his whole life, meaning with the justification of his whole life in all circumstances. Or one can also say this follows, one must think not only of impressing one's competitor and thus possibly repel potential students, or vice versa. Yes, he has to take these two things into consideration at the same time, and some more. Honesty is the best policy, it seems, and not a fictitious candor. Now, how deep that goes, we will see in the figure. Yes?
And you would call pleasant, I said, the things which participate in pleasure or create pleasure? Certainly, he said. Then my meaning is that insofar as they are pleasant, they are good. And my question would imply that pleasure in itself is good. According to your favorite mode of speech, Socrates, let us investigate this, he said. And if the investigation is to the point and the result proves that pleasure and good are really the same, then we will agree. But if not, then we will argue.
You see, Protagoras has become an imitator of Socrates. The roles are completely changed. We have observed in an earlier passage where it appears that he had become the Odysseus, where Socrates was originally Odysseus. Socrates does not reply to this remark. He doesn't wish to rub in. But this is now the situation. Yes. Socrates replies in a somewhat different way.
And would you wish to begin the inquiry, I said, or shall I begin? You ought to take the lead, he said.
You are just in taking the lead. With this ambiguity of the Greek expression, if it means it is your right or your duty, and it's undistinguishable. You are, yes. Why? Because you are in charge of this conversation. Socrates gives Protagoras another choice, as we have seen, and this time he chooses wisely, namely to follow Socrates, because if Socrates is a leader, Protagoras is naturally followed. This is not yet brought out here, but brought out when this subject is repeated. Protagoras now deserves to rule because he is a sensible man, but he is too just to desire. Has made great progress. Good. Yes?
May I employ an illustration, I said? Suppose someone who is inquiring into the health or some other bodily function of another on the basis of that person's general appearance. He looks at his face and at the tips of his fingers.
The well, not the fingers, but the virtues, the visible part of the arm. Not of the fingers only. So, you know, we would look at the most visible part of the body. The hand, if we address the hand and the face. Yes?
And then he says, uncover your chest and back to me, that I may have a better view. That is the sort of thing that I desire in this investigation. Having seen what your attitude is toward good and pleasure, I am minded to say to you, uncover your mind to me, Protagoras, and reveal your attitude toward knowledge, that I may know whether or not...
No, let it stop here. Let it stop here. Now, Sura is, you see, is now the acknowledged leader, and he makes full use of his leadership or rule. He is going to examine not the good as the pleasure, but Protagoras. And he treats Protagoras as a physician treats a patient. Protagoras had doubted whether the good is identical with the pleasure. And Socrates says, so I understand where you stand regarding that, this issue, and I suppose this means you do not wish to concede that the good is identical with the pleasure. Perhaps you believe that the good is something different from the pleasure. You do not know. Well, entirely hope. Yes. Now, how do we go on?
Reveal your attitude for knowledge, that I may know whether or not you agree with the many. Now the many are of opinion that knowledge is not a powerful, lordly, commanding thing. They do not think of it as actually being anything of that sort at all. But their notion is that a man may have knowledge, and yet that the knowledge which is in him may be overmastered by anger, or pleasure, or pain, or love, perhaps by fear?
No, frequently by fear.
Oh.
The only thing of which you said is frequent.
Frequently by fear? Just as if knowledge were nothing but a slave and might be dragged about by all these other things. Now is that your view? Or do you think that knowledge is a noble thing and fit to command in man, which cannot be overcome and will not allow a man, if he only knows the good and the evil, to do anything which is contrary to what his knowledge bids him do, but that wisdom will have strength to help him? I agree with you, Socrates, said Protagoras. And not only so, but I, above all other men, am bound to say that wisdom and knowledge are the mightiest of human things.
Of the human things, yes. Now that is of some importance. Now the many think that knowledge can be overcome by certain things, for example by pleasure. Now this thought of the many was shared in a way by Simonides, 345b, and there apparently approved by Socrates. It is rejected by Protagoras. Now when he seems to qualify it at the end of the passage we now read, that knowledge is the strongest of the human things. What does he mean by that? After all, there are other things which are not human. Yes? For instance, yeah. But broader, that is true. It points in the right direction. Yes? No, that is not necessary. It's also, well, then, on the basis, by leaving open the distinction to what extent these natural disasters are God sent. Yeah. Acts of God. Yes? Yeah, that would also belong to that. But there is a somewhat broader connection. Protagoras has given an account of the whole in his myth. And there it appeared that knowledge was not ruling, and minds were not ruling, but they came in afterwards. Do you remember that? So knowledge doesn't rule things in general, very far from it. But it rules, or can rule, the human things. the wise man is a man in whom the mind inside rules everything else, but not in the universe. This is, I think, the meaning of that qualification. Yes, naturally there is a difference between a disaster, a mishap, and the passion of which he speaks here. But one could perhaps say that the mishaps translate themselves into passion, fear, grief, and so on. Now, clearly, Protagoras says, I cannot possibly say that because I am the man, the sophist, the man of the enlightenment. He is bound to believe in the quasi-omnipotence of knowledge, at least in human affairs. Whereas those who are not men of the enlightenment, like Simonides and Socrates, are under no such compulsion. This seems to be clear. There are five passions mentioned here. The enumeration is not quite clear, but there are five, just as there are five virtues in 349b. I do not believe that there is any correspondence between these two enumerations. Let us see whether we can find some order. Pleasure and pain have to do with the present. Spiritless, confidence, and fear have to do with future evil. And eros, in the sense of desire altogether, with future good. This seems to be the underlying division. The five fundamental passions, we can say. Yes. So we have now together almost all the premises of the following discussion, but we still need a few more lines. Yes.
Good, as I said, and true. But are you aware that the many do not share
the many of the human beings.
Many of the human beings.
Yes.
Of the human do not share your conviction and mine, but claim that many people know the things which are best, but do not do them when they might. And most persons whom I have asked the reason of this have said that when men act contrary to knowledge, they are overcome by pain or pleasure or some of those things which I was just now mentioning.
Now, Socrates and Protagoras agree, at least apparently, as to the supremacy of knowledge, and the many deny it. The many say, and the many prove their point by their knowledge of the many, the judgment of the many about the many. Many knowing the better and able to do it, do the worse, choose the worse, because they are overcome by pleasure, etc. Yes, the point of the many is familiar to every one of us. Someone should not smoke cigarettes and is overcome by the desire for cigarettes. Have a daily experience. And there are also harsher examples which you know, I trust, only from the literature. Good. In other words, that well-known phenomenon of being overcome by passion is incompatible. If Socrates and Protagoras is in unintelligible. If Socrates and Protagoras are right in saying the ruling thing is the mind, it's knowledge. Now, what does Protagoras say?
Yes, Socrates, he replied. And that is not the only point about which mankind is in error.
Yeah, the human beings. Yeah, that is, I must insist on that translation. Protagoras dismisses the view of the many as the view of the many. Who cares for what these fools think? You see, he cared very much when Socrates spoke not of the many, but of the Athenians. Because the Athenians, he was in Athens and they had to be careful But the many in general, as you can say the worst thing about them and nothing happens to them. Now, the many is now replaced, from now on, up to 358 beginning, as you see, for a very long stretch, by the human being. And that is this very strange thing which we must try, if we can, if we are able to understand. Yeah, well, of course, we will not take this snobbish posture of Protagoras and say that at first glance the many got a point. And secondly, Protagoras, being a teacher of the many, must be willing to condescend to these poor fish of the world. So that we do not much know.
Good.
Yes?
Suppose then that you and I endeavor to persuade and explain to them what is the nature of this.
The human beings, all of this.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I have to be pedantic, but otherwise you'll miss something.
To the human, what is the nature of this event which they call being overcome by pleasure, and which they affirm to be the reason why they do not always do what they realize to be best? When we say to them, friends,
no, human beings.
Humans?
Yeah, you see that the key point is these are human beings in general that are not andres, not hombres. That's the point. Yes?
You are mistaken and are saying what is not true. They would probably reply, Protagoras and Socrates, if this event is not to be called being overcome by pleasure, pray tell us what it is and what you would call it. But why, Socrates, need we investigate the opinions of the humans?
Of the many human beings.
Of the many humans.
Yeah.
Who just say anything that comes to their head.
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah. If the many wrongly assert that knowledge can be overcome by pleasure, one must give another account of the phenomenon to which they refer. Man is supposed not to drink water, and he can't restrain himself. These things happen. Socrates and Protagoras are in the same boat regarding supremacy of knowledge, but they differ regarding the relation of the good and the pleasant. The many deny the supremacy of knowledge. Where do they stand regarding the issue of pleasure and the good? Well, I think they implicitly deny that the good is the pleasant by the way in which they raise the question. So let us draw a list of the positions taken respectively by Socrates, Protagoras, and the human being. Socrates, can someone make a painting, a drawing of the blackboard? Socrates just S, yeah? Good equal to pleasant, G equal to P. Supremacy of knowledge is the other answer, yeah? P, Protagoras. Regarding the first point, question mark. We do not know because he simply didn't commit himself. But supremacy of knowledge. Yeah? Same. Now the human beings, they say the good differs from the pleasant, and they assert the inferiority of knowledge. So, well, can we not draw safely this inference that Protagoras is slightly closer than Socrates to the view of the man? Because in one point, Protagoras is not so clearly opposed to the many as Socrates is. Is this clear? Now, despite this fact, Protagoras has a much greater contempt for the opinion of the many than Zuvarese, as you see from his final remark. Or perhaps, this we cannot know, he doesn't wish to discuss this whole issue. And the reason might be this: if we take some contemporary examples as keys, which is always legitimate but always dangerous. Supremacy of knowledge means the superiority of the intellectuals to the non-intellectuals in present-day language. And which intellectual wouldn't believe in this kind of supremacy? But to demand that within the individual intellectual, the intellect should control his desire for reputation and wealth, this probably would go too far for him. Well, we must see to what extent this nasty suspicion is justified in the case of Protagoras. So, now the next point.
I believe, I said, that they may be of use in helping us to discover how courage is related to the other parts of virtue.
Yes. Now, the investigation of the popular view regarding the power of pleasure is important for the understanding of the relation of courage to the other virtues. Why? We find a key in the next line, if you only begin the next sentence.
If you are disposed to abide by our agreement...
Yeah, to abide, to stick to, to stay there, make a stand there. That's the key word. If knowledge is to be quasi omnipotent, it must be able to resist pleasure, etc. It must be able to take a firm stand. It must include courage, because the virtues by which we are able to take a firm stand is meant by courage. The so-called courage, which is swayed by pleasure, is not truly courage. Now, the power over the pleasures is ordinarily called temperance, or moderation. And this would indeed mean that moderation and courage are identical, which would of course follow anyway, given the unity of the virtues, but this point is developed, for example, in the Lache, in the dialogue called Lache at some length. Good. And now let us read the whole speech of
if you were disposed to stick to our agreement that I should show the way in which, as I think, our recent difficulty is most likely to be cleared up, do you follow? But if not, never mind. You are quite right, he said, and I would have you proceed as you have begun.
Yeah. Now, so it gives Protagoras, as you see, another opportunity to make the same choice as he had done in 351e. He makes it now much more explicit, however, that Protagoras follows him. Formerly he had only spoken of his, Socrates, leading. Underlines it. Yes.
Well then.
I do not know, there is a difficulty here which I cannot dispose of. If you do not wish, if it is agreeable to you, I let it go. Now I let it go. And the Greek word is I let it be pleased. Eoshaira. Whether there is any indication of a broader content, I cannot say. The mere fact that there is a double conditional sentence, if you do not wish, if it is all right with you, I will let go, is strange. I mention this only as one of the many points which I cannot solve. Yes. Now, how does he go on?
Well, then, I said, let me suppose that they repeat their question. What account do you give of that which, in our way of speaking, is termed being overcome by pleasure? I should answer this. Listen, and Protagoras and I will endeavor to show you.
Yeah, no. Socrates is now going to tell the many on behalf of himself and Protagoras what the many mean when they say that the many are overcome by pleasure. Very complicated, I can't tell you. But it's obvious that the many have a just claim to hear what this phenomenon, which is undeniable, means if it is not meaning of being overcome by pleasure. And so Socrates will answer this question for them. But he speaks now for Protagoras. Socrates is completely, Socrates has him in his hip pocket. He has nothing else for himself to say. Yes?
When men are overcome by eating and drinking and sexual desires which are pleasant, and they, knowing them to be evil, nevertheless indulge in them, would you not say that they were overcome by pleasure? They will not deny it.
Now wait. He speaks here also addressing these men, human beings. Yeah, that's important. You, when you speak of this thing overcome by pleasure, you mean that you are overcome by sensible pleasures which are bad. That is the phenomenon they have in mind. Protagoras agrees that this is what the many would say. He is very cagey, you see. Yes?
And suppose that you and I were to go on and ask them again. In what way do you say that they are evil? In that they are pleasant and give pleasure at the moment, or because they cause disease and poverty and other like evils in the future? Would they still be evil if they simply gave pleasure and had no attendant evil consequences, regardless of the source and nature of the pleasure they gave? Would they not answer, Protagoras, that they are not evil on account of the pleasure of the moment which they give, but on account of the after effects, diseases, and the like? I believe, said Protagoras, that the world in general,
the many would give this answer. Yeah. The many do not mean that those pleasant things which they overcome are bad because they are pleasant, but they call them bad only with a view to their bad consequences. Protagoras cautiously agrees that this would be the answer of the many, that I believe. I'm not so familiar with them, you see. I believe. But what about those pleasant and bad things which do not lead to sickness, poverty, and the like? For example, undetected adultery. It would follow that the many would not say that this is bad. Yeah? Or take the other case of a deserter who through his desertion escapes death and wounds and acquires wealth. Such cases have been reported. Again, the many would be unable to regard this as bad. I mention this only because this subject will come up later on, after the discussion with the many is completely finished. Now, what does Socrates say on that?
And in causing diseases, do they not cause pain? And in causing poverty, do they not cause pain? They would agree to that also, if I am not mistaken.
No, as I believe. Yes.
Protagoras assented.
Yeah. Now you see, Socrates imitates now Protagoras' caution and cagement, I believe. Socrates and Protagoras completely agree that the many would understand by the bad consequences of pleasure, unpleasant consequences. Yeah.
Then I should say to them, in my name and yours.
Yeah, again, human beings addressing them, yeah? All human beings, yeah? All hominins, yeah?
Humans, do you think them evil for any other reason except because they end in pain and rob us of other pleasures? There again, would they agree? We both of us thought that they would.
Yeah, we both, they are taken out together. Now the agreement between Sukadev and Protagoras, not regarding pleasure and pain, but regarding the opinion of the many, is even more complete, we can say, than it was before. The bad means what lacks pleasure or what is painful. Yes, now.
And then we should take the question from the opposite point of view and say, human, when you speak of goods being painful, do you not mean remedial goods, such as gymnastic exercises and military service, and the physician's use of...
Military campaign, I suppose he means that, as a matter of course. Yeah.
And the physician's use of... burning, cutting, drugging, and starving. Are these the things which are good but painful? They would assent to me? He agreed. And do you call them good because they occasion the greatest immediate suffering and pain, or because afterwards they bring health and physical well-being and the salvation of the city? And
salvation of city?
And salvation of city. And power over others and wealth.
Which is also used in power, wealth over there, and wealth in the poor.
They would agree to the latter alternative
I believe.
Yes. He assented.
Good. Now, the good things which are unpleasant, in contradistinction to the bad things which are pleasant, are unpleasant now and have good consequences in the future. Yeah. Sukadev does not in any way question the vulgar view here. Rule over others and wealth is as good an end of military campaign as the salvation of the city. See, it is truly addressed to the vulgar opinion, to the human being. As you see from the context. You want to say something?
Those things also have to be bad for some rule over other cities. The bad
act. Yeah, but very good. And now what would this, how do you go on from here? To what extent do you consider the other?
Well, I mean, in the view of the many, I suppose that's not considered, but still,
the question itself, under what heading would this, which you raise, under what heading would this come?
What sort of thing is the good? Is the good
just? Yeah, justice. The issue of justice. Justice is completely abstract. I mean, moderation, the control of desire, and courage, the control of fear, is. That's completely abstract. That is part of the whole story. It's a very good you mentioned that. Yeah, and also in the way in which he regards a raging war merely for the sake of enrichment, and in particular of the enrichment of individuals here, as a goal not to be questioned, is of course remarkable. Yeah. That is what you want to make? What did you wish to say?
No.
Good. Now we are in 25. Yes.
Are these things good for any other reason except that they end in pleasure and get rid of and avert pain? Are you looking to any other standard for pleasure and pain when you call them good? They would acknowledge that they were not. I think so, said Protagoras.
No, wait. They would, as I believe, nor do I, and nor does it seem to me so. His cage, Protagoras remains as cage devotee four. Socrates says, then the it goes now. It says clearly, the good is the pleasant. The many have no other standard than the pleasant. The good things which they choose as pleasant, or with a view to their present consequence. Protagoras agrees that the many would say that. He doesn't say anything about his view up to this point. Yes?
And do you not pursue pleasure as a good and avoid...
Yeah, you is of course here, that can come out in the English.
Ye.
In the plural, yeah. And it's naturally the many, not Protagoras. Yeah.
Do you not pursue pleasure as a good? And avoid pain as an evil.
Yes.
He assents. Then you think that pain is an evil and pleasure is a good. And even pleasure you deem an evil when it robs thee of greater pleasures than it gives, or causes pain greater than the pleasure. If, however, you call pleasure an evil in relation to some other end or standard, you will be able to show us that standard. But ye have none to show. I do not think that they have, said Protagoras.
You see, the many regard, certain pleasant things as bad only from the point of view of pleasure. Protagoras again agrees as to the many holding this view. Socrates is very circumstantial here, as you see, but for one reason, if he speaks to the many, people supposedly very slow-witted, and of course, why this thing which is easy to understand, everyone knows this kind of hedonism since his childhood, more or less, today, it has been elaborated many times since, but this makes us easily forget this strange happenings here. While what is taught is very simple to understand, the way in which it is taught is very complicated, because we must also see Socrates wants to convince Protagoras, and Protagoras doesn't say a word. Protagoras only says the many would say that, and he keeps his own view back. Yes, now where were we? In D4, I believe. Huh?
And again, have ye not a similar way of speaking about pain? Ye call pain a good when it takes away greater pain than those which it has, or gives pleasures greater than the pain. Then, if ye have some other standard than pleasure and pain to which ye refer when you call actual pain a good, ye can show us what that is, but ye cannot. True, said Protagoras.
Yeah. Has a slightly different answer. The many regard certain unpleasant things as good, of course also with a view to pleasure. There's no independent standard. Protagoras' reply is now ambiguous. He doesn't say that is what the many say. Is he now willing to concede that the good is identical with the pleasant, as well as one thing to consider? We do not know. Well, I will only tell you one thing. You all had heard somewhere, sometime, somehow, about the calculus of pleasure. And that the whole morality, the whole moral problem consists in the calculus of pleasure. This is the thought which is here developed for the first time. And if this is so, if the moral problem is the calculus of pleasure, then of course virtue is knowledge. Choosing the good means choosing the pleasant, i.e. the greatest pleasure. And that is the mathematical problem. Well, in the mathematics of pleasure, which is not quite the same as that of numbers and geometrical figures. And that is what he is working his way to. But the circumstantial and elaborate character is due not to the novelty of the thought, because the thought is easy to follow, but to this particular caginess of God, of Protagoras, who does not wish to grant that what Protagoras wants him to grant for some reason which we do not yet know. Yes?
Suppose
and but not what I'm interested in is only this point which we have mentioned before. There is by no means a wholesale acceptance of the Roman order and the Roman laws as simply good, but a constant criticism of the important details, as we know. And let us read the last paragraph on page 117. This is a conclusion. Page 500.
I will just so briefly, if I can. From Marcus Julian, your father's friend, dedicated to him a long treatise of the subject, which was written with learning and care, I think. Now, we want to investigate and discuss the law of nature independently, but in regard to the Roman law, we must follow precedent and tradition.
Yeah, unfortunately, that seems to be incomplete, for what Atticus said. All right. Here, I only draw your attention to the clear-cut distinction again between literal legislators, the right of nature and the right of the Roman people. The right of nature is a rational. Therefore, we can know it, reflect about it by ourselves. But as for the right of the Roman people, we have that positive. We have to depend on what is given to us by the authority, and therefore especially by the authorities of former times, by the tradition. This is, cannot be taken to be the end of the whole book, of course, because the book has at least 5 books, and the rest is completely missing. We have to consider a few, some passages in the first book. And I believe what is equally necessary, and more necessary perhaps, is to put together the thread of the argument of Cicero, as we have discerned it up to now, the political argument, before we turn to the opposite. And I think we should do that next time. Risking, running the risk of being compelled to ask Mr. Jack to read his paper on your Thursday. But you have it, please have it ready.
I'm ready.
Good. I think we should try to put the whole argument together and see whether any clear pattern has emerged, especially regarding this grave issue of natural law. Do you want to say something, Mr. Professor?
No, I think the very nature then. My suggestion to me that the nature of this is a ruling court, a ruling court in the universe, rather than a condition of the state in the universe.
But you see, the difficulty is the word forward. Since the time of Newton and Leibniz, this word has become so common in physics and migrated from there into general thought. You must not forget that the